This episode is part of the Pool's Local Officials Stronger Together podcast series. It's one way we serve local officials through integrity, public service, fiscal responsibility, and operational excellence. As always, please direct specific questions about coverage to your risk management advisor.
Welcome to the Local Officials Stronger Together podcast series. I'm your host, Scott Houston. In this episode, we'll be talking about the drug overdose crisis in America. In 2023, the Centers for Disease Control estimated over 100,000 overdose deaths in the United States. Texas had almost 6,000 of those, with half being from fentanyl. That's 275 people dying every day in our country from overdoses. That's more people than a fully loaded airliner crashing every single day. And make no mistake, those dying aren't what you think is stereotypical drug users. In this episode, I'll do two things. First, I'll talk with Arkansas Municipal League Executive Director Mark Hayes. I got to know Mark when I was general counsel at the Texas Municipal League, and he served as the general counsel at his league. We would visit periodically at legal conferences and other times. Mark is an amazing guy, and he's got an amazing blended family, almost literally like the Brady Bunch, I hear. But in 2020, he lost his son Wells to an overdose right in their own house. I hadn't spoken to Mark in a while, but I recently heard him and his wife, Allison, tell Wells' story on another podcast, the City Speak podcast, hosted by Clarence Anthony at the National League of Cities. It's a heartbreaking story, but they tell it to honor Wells' memory and hopefully prevent others from suffering as they have. I do want to warn you, most of our podcasts are pretty lighthearted, but the story you're about to hear is anything but lighthearted. In fact, it's brutal, and I'm sure it could be triggering for some. But Wells' story really stuck with me. So when I saw a news article about the city of Laredo's drug overdose prevention efforts, I thought it would be perfect to give that city the Pool's Partnership Award. I presented that award at a recent city council meeting and later spoke with Laredo Police Chief Miguel Rodriguez about what the city is doing. And they're doing a lot. The city is supporting awareness campaigns, recovery and treatment options, Narcan availability, law enforcement prosecution efforts, and much more. Check out the links below the podcast for more information, and let's get to the interviews. This is only the second one of these that we've done that's so compelling, I'll go longer than the usual 15 minutes, around half an hour for this one. And again, if you aren't ready for whatever reason to hear Wells' story, you can skip to about 20 minutes in for the Laredo portion of the podcast. As I mentioned in the intro, Mark and Allison lost their son Wells to an overdose in 2020, and they pledged not to let his death be in vain, and that's why they tell the story of Wells wherever they can, and I'm so honored to have Mark here today. Mark and I have known each other for a long time in the municipal law world and have continued to stay in touch as we moved into the executive roles. Mark, thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much. We're always, as a family, happy to accommodate these kinds of things and do this sort of presentation. We think the more that's spoken, the better chance we have of saving people. So I'm very honored to do this. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you so much. Let's start with, just tell me a little bit about Wells, what kind of a kid he was growing up, and a little bit about him personally.
Wells was all boy through and through. I used to laugh. He came into my life at age 10, and I would laugh. He could eat a saltine cracker and look like he'd had a chocolate cake. It was I've just never seen a whirlwind of crumbs and activity coming off of one person in my entire life. He loved to fish. He loved to hunt, duck hunting in particular. He was a great golfer, just left-handed. His hand-to-eye coordination was just amazing. And really, he loved doing things that he loved to do. And he was all in on those things. Now, the things that involved some level of work, such as schoolwork and the like, he was loath to do. And all the other kids, the other three, used to say, as soon as it's time to clean up after dinner, he would just suddenly disappear or pretend to be carrying things from the table into the kitchen when he really wasn't. And it kind of was a family joke, you know. Unfortunately, it's a pattern that developed all of his life. And ultimately, I think is in large part why he's no longer with us. He was never a great student, and yet I'm pretty convinced he was probably the smartest one of the whole group. I told Clarence this in the NLC podcast. He went on a trip to the Galapagos Islands when he was 13, and when he came back, he was able to tell us almost like a picture for us. He could almost paint the whole trip every single day, everything he saw, all the things that he loved, the things that were really strange, the things that were interesting, the people he met. I mean, it was fascinating when he was engaged in something, just how, you know, how much he was engaged. I wouldn't say he had a photographic memory for that sort of thing, but he certainly had a very deep understanding for things that he really liked. Well, it's so not, we rocked along through high school. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it sounds like, you know, he was a really fun kid all the way around.
He's hilarious.
And you were moving into his high school days, and it sounded like he had a lot of fun through high school. But then you mentioned as well on the NLC podcast that when he went off to school, he was asked to come home after that first year. And that really,
right.
That really hit home for me, Mark, because that same thing happened to me. I went off to the University of Texas, and it just wasn't a good time. And I was ultimately asked to come home too and take a time out. And I can just tell you, it was a really difficult time personally for me. So I can really relate to how somebody might feel going through that and coming home, and when, you know, other peers may be doing other things. And so tell me a little bit about that part.
Yeah, it was, and I've talked to him through his senior year in high school about not going to college for at least a year, maybe two. It was clear he wasn't mature enough, and that his study habits weren't there, and so on and so forth. But he was going to do it come hell or high water, and that's where all of his friends were going, and he wasn't going to be left behind. So he went up and he pledged the same fraternity that Colin, one of our other sons, pledged. Colin was a senior at the time. And he was a great pledge and very engaging. But the great point that first semester was dreadful. When he came home, he professed that he didn't understand how that could possibly be. Well, you know, we went back, tracked everything and with him in front of the computer screen, and he didn't want to admit it. But the truth was, he didn't really even go to class. So he had a grade point that was nothing to the left of the decimal point. So if that tells you anything. And then he wanted to go back, and it caused one of the, probably the biggest, not the biggest, but certainly one of the serious headbuttings between my wife and I. I thought it was a terrible idea to send him back. He was clearly not capable of handling it, and I wanted to do some other things. But, you know, mom won, and off he went, and then they asked him not to come back. He would not admit those first 3 or 4 months he was home that summer that he was anxious and that he was depressed and that he couldn't handle it. And he was ostracized from his group, or at least he thought he was. And it just started this sort of slow spiral that then it really went fast towards the end.
And do you think think Wells has started using his school, or do you think that started when he came home?
Well, I think he had dabbled a little bit late in high school and some in college. He was certainly smoking weed. We knew that. And he was drinking. But I think he was probably experimenting a little bit. And I think when he got back, he continued that pattern of behavior, and it didn't take him long to get hooked. You know, I think it just, at that point, you move from the, you know, the pills, because you're stealing them, and then if you've got to buy them on the street, they're expensive, and then pretty soon you move into black tar heroin. He was smoking it, and it got mixed with fentanyl. That's ultimately what killed him. But I think he was starting to tinker with it late high school through that first year in college.
And so tell me what that was like after, you know, as you described it, things started kind of going downhill. He was still living at home with y'all, right?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, it was pretty bad, actually. It was getting at a point where it was destroying our marriage, destroying the family dynamic. He was stealing from us. All of the sort of horribly classic what addicts do, what addictive behavior is. And he couldn't hold a job and kept getting fired. And it got at a point where I said, Allison, we have to do something. We threw him out just for a short period of time, hoping to kind of awaken him a little bit. It didn't work. And then soon thereafter was the first overdose that we knew of. And I'll just say this, we know of five. I think there may be as many as seven, but we're really not sure how many, at least two of which his friends tossed him at the front door at a hospital. We didn't learn about those two until after he was dead. There were several near death experiences too. And I mean, within seconds, he was saved in very dramatic and ugly fashion, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But he would wake up from it. He just wouldn't. So we put him in rehab one time. He came back and within, I don't know, 30 days, he was using again. And then he just damn near died. And we took him down to a year long program. And he got thrown out of it after about 5 months because he and another kid started using over-the-counter stuff that you could buy in Alabama. And I don't remember the name of it, but it's, you see them in little bottles all over the place. And they were buying 30 and 40 of them at a crack and getting high off of them. And when confronted, finally, the other kid admitted they'd been doing it. They let him stay. Well, Wells never would admit it. And he finally said, "We're not coming to get you. If they throw you out, you're on your own." And he spent about 8 or 9 days in a homeless center in downtown Birmingham, Alabama. So you can imagine what that was like. He got sick. And then again, another problem between Allison and I, and she went and got him. And then that, it wasn't just a month or so later that he died.
Now, man, I know this is so hard, and it's so hard to talk about it, but it's so important that we honor his memory.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about how that was? I listened to the NLC podcast again last night, and it was just had me in tears. But can you tell us a little bit about how that was, so people can really understand what that's like?
Yeah, it's almost as though there aren't enough words in my vocabulary or anybody's to fully get the impact of it. You live in constant fear that you're either going to get a call that he's dead or in jail. And it was just this whirlwind of crisis behavior and these overdoses, in literally within seconds dying and then being put on a ventilator for 3 days, and you show him pictures of it. And he would look you in the eye and say, I'm not using. I don't have a problem. I don't know what you're talking about." The denial level, it was just awful. And you're confronted with this reality, except the person who needs to be truly realistic about it just won't play ball at all. And I mean, there were tears and there were fights. He threatened Allison at one point in time, and I was out of state actually when it happened, and I called a friend of mine who's has some law enforcement background. I sent him right over there. I called Wells. I said, "You are not to go to the house at all. And if you show up on the front step, the police are going to get called. You've threatened your mother, and that's not going to, you know, it's just not going to work. And I'm going to consider charges." And so we did all of those kinds of things too. It was just bedlam, and it just shredded relationships across the entire family, and the tears, I just can't even begin to describe it. And then the fatal day and evening, unfortunately, really sort of in a nutshell, is what the terror was all like. We had a pretty good idea that the night before that he was using, and Allison and I said, "He's got to throw him out. He has got to go out." And that was another big fight between the two of us. It was awful. And we were crying and mad at each other. And she said, "All right, fine. In the morning, I'll go get a test." And I told him when he went downstairs that he was supposed to be upstairs at 9 o'clock. I really didn't hold out much hope that he would do that, but I wanted it to be clear what was going to happen. And she went and got the test. He still hadn't come up. And so we went downstairs. His bedroom door was open, but his bathroom door was closed and locked and was on. So I kicked it open, and he was in his boxers laying on his back, left leg up underneath the right leg, blood under his head where he'd obviously passed out and cracked the back of his head, vomit all over his face and eyes. And he was already cold. I wouldn't say cold, but cool to the touch. But I leapt in and I did CPR for 2 or 3 minutes. It's 911 on the call. I think in my heart of hearts, I knew he was dead. I just wouldn't give up. And cops were there first, and one of them took over, and I knew one of them and I've known him for a long time. And I could just tell the way he was looking at me. And when I finally said, "You take to his partner, you take over the CPR. I want to go find Allison," because she'd gone upstairs to meet the ambulance and the EMTs. And I think we both probably knew, but this is the worst. This is one of the worst things. When we were told that he was dead, moms just feel this so much deeper than dads do. You know, 9 months of nurturing and internally, and then you come forth with this baby that you brought into the world. The wails from her were like a wild animal being wounded. It was, and we're in our front yard, because at this point the cops have taped it off like potentially a crime scene. We know it's not, but that's what they have to do. We wait on the coroner. It was almost 3 hours before they brought him up in a body bag. And it is bright yellow, awful body bag. And they roll him out. Our Episcopal priest was there and said, "Let's do last rites." So right smack dab in the middle of our front yard doing this. Everybody, neighbors are all freaked out, looking at you, and we're crying, and Allison's just beside herself. And as they roll him away, she's trying to grab a hold of him and keep you. I have to literally physically pick her up and hold her to keep her from going after the coroner and the van. And it's just gut-wrenching, just absolutely gut-wrenching. And it took, or I mean, you never get over this. Let me be very clear to anybody maybe listening. If you lose a child, you never ever get over it. You learn how to cope. But I'll tell you, out of the clear blue sky, sometimes you just get walloped. You have no idea what triggered it or why. I made sure my family was okay for the better part of 2 years. And, you know, don't forget, this is during COVID too. So he, you know, part of his depression, I'm pretty convinced, not only at being out of school, it was just he was so limited in what he could do because of the pandemic. And we only had 12 people at his service, just immediate family. That's all we could do. So the pandemic really compounded all of this emotion. I took care of my family for 2 years and made sure they were all getting counseling and all that sort of stuff. And then one day I started having flashbacks, like I was literally living it all over again. And it just locked me up. So I had to go get some help for myself too. So it's brutal. It's just vicious, and it's brutal, and it's an epidemic, and it literally is taking a generation away.
And it takes so much courage for you and Allison on other venues to speak about this. And I mean, I feel like Clarence did. I don't know exactly what to say other than thank you for doing this, because what's the point of talking about that? It's so that others can understand, and maybe we can save one or many just by listening to this story. So tell me what you would like folks to take away from what you went through. And then we'll talk a little bit about some of the things that y'all are trying to do up there to work on the overdose epidemic in general.
So first and foremost, never, ever shut a deaf ear. Don't shut your hearing off, and don't shut your eyesight off. And if it doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense. And so if something feels wrong, if there's a group of people that are suddenly in your child's life, or even, you know, your partner or your husband or your wife or whatever, whoever it may be, but if there are suddenly people in and odd behaviors and strange conversations, and you better look, and you better look hard. What I think people don't understand is the level of stigma that's still out there is awful. And, you know, I don't like the fact that I had that Wells was an addict, and I sure as hell don't like the fact that he's dead, but pretending like everything is just back to normal is just that. It's pretending. And you have got to pay. If you're a parent, please listen to me. Go look at their phone. Go find out where they're going at night. Figure out what they're doing on the weekends. Get them engaged in positive activities. If you see even the slightest hint of anxiety or depression, get it dealt with quickly. Go to a family counselor to start with. Get a private counselor. Do whatever you need to do. You are not that child's friend. You are their parent. And so, parent, don't be a friend. Put a hard line in the dirt and say, this is what we're doing, and this is why we're going to do it. But don't turn a deaf ear. You will pay a dear, dear price that I would hope nobody has to go through like we did. So listen and pay attention. Those are really the big things. And make sure you get as much education about things as possible so you can talk to your kid about what, you know, what's really out there. I mean, this idea that you just throw a bunch of pills in a bowl now and you just take one, you have no idea what the hell it is. And if it's the illegal drug manufacturing world really doesn't care about quality control. Fentanyl is easily produced, and it is extremely deadly, even in the most minute of forms. And it's now laced in. I'm hearing now, just I talked to a cop friend of mine over the weekend, and that some weed that people are buying is laced with fentanyl. So it's everywhere, and it will kill immediately. It doesn't care whether you're male or female. It doesn't care whether you're black or white, Protestant or Catholic. None of that matters. Rich, poor, it is an equal opportunity killer, and it is an epidemic. So don't kid yourself. Pay attention to what your family members are doing.
The whole point of talking about Wells' story is to let people know just that, that it can happen to anybody, anywhere, anytime.
Correct.
Let's now talk about what cities are doing to combat this epidemic. The state of Texas received settlement money from drug manufacturers, and some of that was distributed to cities a couple of years ago. And even before Wells overdose, Mark was very passionate about this in his home state of Arkansas. The Arkansas League partnered with the Arkansas County Association to bring their own lawsuit against the drug manufacturers, and they were awarded north of $30 million to provide grants to anyone making a difference in their state. I've linked below to the partnership that's overseeing that if you're interested. But now I want to talk about what one city is doing right here in Texas.
We're now joined by Chief Miguel Rodriguez from the city of Laredo. Welcome, Chief.
Well, thank you for having me. This is a very important issue and a pressing issue in major cities and communities throughout the U.S. And our city was hit hard last year. And I think it's a great thing that this is something that's being put out there for the public to get more awareness, and for the victims of those that have passed on an overdose, that they know that we're doing something about it.
Yeah, it's very important. And I think cities do have a role in this. Tell me, what prompted your city to dedicate the resources that it has to this epidemic?
Well, I can tell you this, that 2022, I was an assistant chief for the City of Laredo Police Department. And one of the things that I was assigned to is to make sure that the intelligence that was collaborated throughout the city, partnerships that we have with different law enforcement agencies, was always there. But one of the things is that we always keep stats on things that we see that is going into a red zone. That's what we call it. And one of the things that we started seeing an increase in was in overdoses. So we started getting into conversations with the health department, because we felt that it was a trend at that point, that it was a trend that we needed to make the public aware that there was an issue, right? And so talking to Richard Chamberlain, who was the health director for the city, we started talking about numbers. And I said, look, it's the numbers that was at that time year to date was, you know, already surpassed what we had had in overdoses the year prior. So it was a concern. And, you know, we talked about it and we said, hey, we need to create more public awareness as to, you know, the drugs that they're taking. At that point, we knew fentanyl was there, but we hadn't seen it in our city as much as other cities had. So we started getting together with DEA and the medical examiner, because we needed to have more data as to how is it that we have more deaths. And when that happened, we started getting the toxicology reports and things like that. And one of the things that we started seeing, it was that there was a presence in fentanyl. So when that happened, we immediately started having more conversations with different stakeholders, specifically elected officials, that we wanted to make sure that they knew and that they started putting that awareness out there to the public that, you know, it's here, right? And it's hitting our city.
And what did you do in response to that?
We started talking to DEA, and one of the things that we said, okay, so we have to do different approaches to this. One is going to be the public awareness, public education. The other thing is make sure that we go to the schools and that they understand the danger of this drug and what it causes, right? So when we started doing this on our end for police, I started talking to the DEA, to the district attorney's office, to the assistant U.S. attorney's office, because we wanted to prosecute those that were providing the drug. Because in order to slow it down, the strategy was that we need to get to not only the dealer, not only the one that sold it, but the mid-level suppliers.
Are the mid-level folks that you're talking about, or just the street-level dealers, are they being charged with more crimes than just selling drugs? Are they being charged with additional crimes because of the deaths that they've caused?
So what they're being charged with, it's a federal charge that carries 20-year sentence. We've heard the word in the street from different sources that, you know, try not to sell anything with fentanyl because they're coming after you. And that's exactly the strategy that we wanted to do. That exactly what the message that we wanted to send. And so far, it's been great, but we're not going to rest until we get down to zero.
That's amazing. And those law enforcement efforts are truly amazing that you've described to us, and the successes that you've had. And I know you're going to continue working on those. I know the city also is kind of putting a full court press on this, in addition to those law enforcement efforts that you and your stakeholders and partners are making. Are there other things you can tell us about? I know there's the Roots Recovery Center. There's public awareness campaigns. I thought the Narcan vending machines was a really interesting idea. Maybe some of those things you could mention?
Yes, absolutely. So partnering up again, the collaboration has been phenomenal. In the city of Laredo, we're talking about the fire chief and our health director. Those guys have been pushing this, and they've been going 100 miles an hour with us. And you know, the fire chief has been one that has been pushing, hey, you know, let's put the Narcan out there. Let's make sure that every police officer has Narcan available to be able to help the people that are going through this crisis. And also the firemen, everybody has Narcan at this point. And then the health director came in and said, hey, why don't we put vending machines, you know, in public areas where it's easy access to go get Narcan for, you know, for those families that they know that they have an individual that's addicted to any kind of substance, that they're ready to just go in and make sure that they save their lives while they're going through this. As we all know, it takes a toll on families when you have somebody that has been, you know, that is going through this. And so we're trying to make it easier on them to be able to save their lives and for them to accept the fact that at any given point, this can happen and you just need to be ready. So they've done that. The health director has been pushing this and has been a great partner with us. And aside from that, we also got the mayor and council. You know, we got doctors in council, and the mayor's a doctor himself. And so they're all hands on this, and they're also, you know, very supportive of this. And the Dr. Victor Trevino, who is our mayor, he's been very loud about, you know, hey, we need to get this out to the public. We need to continue pushing the note that create this awareness. And he's been with us every step of the way.
What else have you been doing?
We're continuing to put resources on the overdose response team, but we're also getting things like there's a technology with a drone technology that we're purchasing, and that drone has the capability of carrying Narcan. So,
wow, that's cool. That's really cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so you just fly the drone to where the person's having their overdose event, and just wow.
Exactly. Exactly. So we get there as before the fire department gets there, before PD gets there, and they're going through an overdose. The drone will be out there and be able to, you know, release that Narcan so that they can assist that person.
That's really cool. And, you know, part of the reason we bestow a partnership award on cities, which we did, of course, for Laredo for your efforts in this area. Part of the reason we do that is to bring awareness to other cities that they can emulate or copy what it is that you're doing in a way that can better their city as well. So that's really something special, all these neat things that y'all are doing. One more question I wanted to ask.
Yes, of course.
When we talk about replicating efforts, the city of Laredo also has the Laredo Drug and Alcohol Commission, right?
Correct,
and
yes.
And that's council-appointed, or is it a mayor-appointed or council-appointed committee?
It's a council-appointed committee, and they've done a lot of things.
They definitely have, and I've linked to the commission's webpage below the podcast.
Well, everybody at the city of Laredo should be very, very proud of the programs that you're implementing to fight this epidemic. I'm going to link to all the different things that we've talked about and some that we haven't that are things that the city is doing so that other city officials can look at those and emulate them if they feel it's appropriate for their city. So I can't thank you enough, Chief, for what you're doing and for taking a few minutes to visit with me about this very important issue. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention before we go?
No, I mean, we're here. Doors open whenever you want to come by and chat or want to send anybody our way. Just let us know and we'll be able to communicate with them and make sure that we put our ideas there on the table and see if we can help as much as possible any other city.
Awesome. Thank you for being here, Chief. Appreciate you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. We'll be right back with your action items for this episode. Let's do just two action items for this episode. First, please listen to and hear Mark's advice. The epidemic knows no societal boundaries. Next, take a look at what the city of Laredo is doing to fight this problem. They really are attacking it from many angles, and that's why we were honored to present them with our partnership award. That's it. Thanks for being our partner, and be sure to tune in to another episode soon.
To review written materials associated with the presentation or to ask Scott a question, please visit www.tmlirp.org and click on the Stronger Together podcast link. Please remember that the information in this episode is provided for informational purposes only and doesn't constitute legal advice. We recommend that you review the podcast and the accompanying written materials with your attorney prior to taking action.